Shrink Wrap Radio number 48, August 24th, 2006, Virtual Reality and Psychology. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
This is where the VR really makes a big difference, and particularly with PTSD, where one of the cardinal symptoms is avoidance of cues and reminders of the traumatic event. So in VR, we know what the person is seeing, hearing, smelling, and feeling. We have a vibration platform as well that we use. It's pretty low cost. And we can systematically control the stimulus presentation. So you start off in a Humvee that's driving through an area that looks like Mojave, but by session 8 or 9, you've got Iraqi buildings in the desert. You've got insurgents popping up, helicopters flying over, the sound of weaponry going off in the distance or getting closer, vehicles exploding off in the distance, and so forth. So you have a range of control within this simulation. So probably the best metaphor is just as an aircraft simulator would test and train piloting ability, we can design virtual environments that test, train, treat, assess, rehabilitate folks in a similar manner.
That was the voice of psychologist Dr. Albert Skip Rizzo, who is a research scientist at the University of Southern California in their Institute for Creative Technologies. I learned about Skip's work as the result of a fascinating article in the August issue of Wired magazine. The article described his research into adapting a virtual reality video game called Full Spectrum Warrior to treat post-traumatic syndrome among soldiers returning from Iraq. This project has received widespread media attention, and there are links to these stories and interviews on his website. Dr. Rizzo conducts research on the design, development, and evaluation of virtual reality systems targeting the assessment and training and rehabilitation of spatial abilities, attention, memory, executive function, and motor abilities. Additionally, he's conducting research on VR or virtual reality applications that use 360-degree panoramic video for exposure therapy in such things as social phobia and role-playing applications in such things as anger management. He's also investigating the use of VR for pain distraction at the Los Angeles Children's Hospital and is currently designing game-based physical rehabilitation VR scenarios for the elderly and persons with impairments due to central nervous system dysfunction. He's the associate editor of the journal Cyber Psychology and Behavior. He's a senior editor of the MIT Press journal Presence, Teleoperators, and Virtual Environments, and he's on a number of editorial boards for journals in the areas of cognition and computer technology. So, let's get into the interview. Hi, Skip. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for having me on board here.
Yeah, I'm really excited to have you on the show. I read the article in Wired magazine, and it featured your work, so I'm kind of starstruck, you know, reading about you in a magazine, and I'm talking to a psychological celebrity.
Yeah. Let's hope the data justifies all the hype.
Okay. Okay, I think part of the reason I'm so excited about this is I'm a technology geek myself, and your work feeds into my boy scientist fantasies, although I'm much too old to be having boy scientist type fantasies.
Right. I think this is something that most psychologists have deep down inside.
Yeah.
They want to have neat tools. They want to have things that they can do with their hands and be able to do some good things with them. And I think that's what got me into pursuing this line of work. You know, I had done clinical work for about 9 years and always felt that, you know, we need some tools that can improve our efficiency mm-hmm. and entice our clients in a certain way to get engaged when they're not so engaged, and when you're dragging them kicking and screaming through the therapeutic process. And that was partially why I started to think about virtual reality when I became aware of it. It just seemed like a good tool that if we use it properly, we can really make a big difference with.
Yeah. Well, before we get into virtual reality per se, I'd be a little bit more interested in, or rather interested in finding out a little bit more about your background. How did you get into, you know, what drew you into psychology? How did you get into this crazy field in the first place?
Well, I was sort of a child of the late 60s, early 70s, and I think that says a lot about why people go into psychology. But at that time, I was really on this quest. And my first semester in college, I took a psychology course with no idea about what I wanted to do. And from the end of the first class, I knew that's what I wanted to do. It just hit me, and it was at the time in my life when I was asking a lot of questions, you know, for existential-type questions. Mm-hmm. And psychology just came at the right time. So that's really what happened. And then, you know, you get over the honeymoon phase.
Right.
And then you actually got to take statistics and methodology and all the things that you say, well, geez, I just want to help people and I want to understand humanity. And now I got to, you know, understand how to do all this research stuff. But then, you know, fortunately for me, after I started to get engaged in it and I got over the initial shock of that, I started to really like that stuff.
Yeah, you got hooked on the research, it looks like. You've been extremely productive in the research area. Among others, there are a certain number of students who listen to this show, and they might want to follow in your tracks. Can you give us a quick overview of your academic background?
Sure. Well, I started off, you know, doing a regular bachelor's degree in psychology, University of Hartford, and not sure what direction I would take, except that I knew I wanted to be a clinician, but I also enjoyed research. And at the time when I applied to graduate school, I didn't get into a PhD clinical program, but I had some graduate student friends that had advised me that as a backup, to get a master's, go into a master's degree program in experimental psych.
I did the same thing.
Yeah. Where did you go, by the way?
Well, undergraduate, University of Pennsylvania, undergraduate major, creative writing. So then I had to do something remedial to get into a clinical. Mm-hmm. Ended up going to the University of Montana, getting a master's in general experimental, and from there, right. University of Michigan in clinical. But I interrupted you. So you got a master's?
I did my bachelor's at the University of Hartford, and it didn't have, at the time, there wasn't a really strong research emphasis. Well, I thought I got a good education, but I didn't have the research background at the time to really be competitive for a PhD program. But I got into the experimental psych program at the University of New Orleans and, you know, worked hard for 2 years, got a few publications out, and then got into the PhD clinical program that had just started up at State University of New York in Binghamton. This is a program started by Don Levis and Steve Lisman, Ray Romancic. These were really, people that were really strong in the cognitive behavioral area and had a strong belief in being an empirical clinician.
Mm-hmm.
So that you had to, if you were going to be a clinician, you had to be also have good research tools or research skills in order to advance the field through solid science and not just shooting from the hip. That's where my graduate work. Then from there, I developed an interest in neuropsychology and mm-hmm. chose to come out to California for my internship at the Long Beach VA. There was a neuropsychologist there, Jeff Webster, that I wanted to work with, and I got in there and did some work with him, and right out of the internship, got a position in a brain injury rehabilitation program. This was back in mid-80s, and it was sort of, there was sort of a lot of energy in the idea of neuropsychology also going beyond just assessment and going into cognitive rehabilitation. And so when I started doing that work, I really started to work in an interdisciplinary environment, a lot of occupational therapists, speech therapists, social workers, and so forth. And so it was a real strong interdisciplinary energy there that helped me to see how treatment could be done aside from a pure neuropsychology perspective, clinical psychology perspective as well. And so that was my clinical work, which I ended in 1994, I believe. Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's get into the work that was described in the Wired magazine article. Tell us about the virtual reality game Full Spectrum Warrior you developed and how you got into that in the first place. And maybe, actually, you might need to start and explain what virtual reality is.
Okay. Well, as sort of a prelude to that, I think a rationale for even being interested in virtual reality in the first place might be in order.
Yeah.
When I was doing the brain injury work in the early 90s, I noticed that with the introduction of Game Boys, that a lot of the younger 18 to 24-year-old head injured individuals that I worked with were starting to get these Game Boys. And at every break they had, you would see them out in the yard playing these handheld devices, these Game Boys. And I didn't know what it was. And I went over and asked one of them, and he goes, "Yeah, there's this game called Tetris, and let me see that." And so I started playing it. And it dawned on me that, you know, these were clients that were very difficult to motivate to do the kinds of rehabilitation exercises, cognitive rehab exercises. And so, consequently, it struck me that here, it was hard to motivate them to do traditional rehab, but they were spending hours a day playing this game, and they were getting better at the game, and they were devoted to it. And it really struck me that, you know, if we could engage these folks, unfortunately, Tetris doesn't really translate into functional everyday living skills that well.
Right.
But, it does work attention and some visual, spatial, eye-hand coordination. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, I'd also just gotten a Nintendo 64 game that had the game SimCity with it. And that game is probably, if you're not familiar with it, it's probably one of the best executive function training exercises that you could ever really play. It requires you to make decisions on the fly when you're building your cities, analyze incoming information, come up with a strategy based on that information, repair your strategy if it goes awry, and it's all happening in real time. So I brought that in and found, once again, that students or clients that were very challenging to motivate in traditional cognitive rehab would spend hours building these cities, and we could get them to work cooperatively in pairs to build cities, which was, I thought, an important everyday living skill that could translate into occupational success. So at that point, virtual reality had come to the fore and basically made the decision at that point that if I wanted to pursue the idea of applying simulation technology for cognitive assessment and rehab, that I'd probably have to be at a university. So I took a postdoc at USC, University of Southern California, Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. And that was my sneaking in through the back door at USC initially, and bugged a few people in computer science for access to equipment, which at that time in the mid-90s was very expensive to do virtual reality.
Right.
But finally somebody said, "Yes, I have some equipment," and the idea that I wanted to do seemed sound. And so they gave me access to equipment, and I started building virtual environments and doing controlled tests in terms of measuring performance and improving performance. And that's from that point, it's just grown in the last 10 years. The technology's advanced so that we can do virtual reality on a laptop with a $600 head-mounted display as opposed to the $200,000 Silicon Graphics engine that I used back in the mid-90s and the $20,000 headset. So along the way, the technology advanced and the things that we could do in virtual reality also continued to evolve. And so that's how I've gotten to the position where I am now. And that position really involves looking at ways now that we can use this type of simulation technology, but also in some cases with games, to motivate and to to do things that are very challenging to do otherwise.
And because the person's wearing a headset, and I guess they've got special earphones on, it's very immersive. Is that right? They actually feel like they're in the game?
That is the key element right there. I mean, you can make a case that any computer game that allows you to navigate within a world, you're actually navigating through a virtual reality environment because you can actually navigate through it and go into the environment. But when you're wearing a head-mounted display, there's a tracking device on it that allows the computer to know where your head is turned at any given point in time and to update the graphics in a manner that gives you this sense, as you say, of being in the environment. So it's different than just playing on a computer screen. You're actually in the world. So you turn your head to the left, you see something to the left, you look up, you see the sky, you look down, you see the ground, you turn around, you see whatever's behind you. And so it's more immersive.
Wow. Yes. According to that Wired article, you really put a lot of effort into achieving a high degree of realism, including not only visual and audio, but also smells.
Yes, we have. Well, for this application, this is an approach for treating post-traumatic stress disorder, doing what we call exposure therapy, which involves graduated systematic exposure to the feared or trauma-relevant stimuli, and by a process of extinction, the person gets, in simple terms, they get used to the stimuli and then can move into the environment in a deeper level where the stimuli may become closer to the traumatic event. So in order to maximize that kind of exposure in a real deep manner, we try to use multi-sensory stimuli whenever it's pragmatically, whenever it's technically possible and whenever it makes pragmatic sense. So we have a smell machine that's relatively low cost. I think it retails at about $1,400. And it has little slots in it that allow us to put scent vials into these slots. There's eight of them. And so on a keystroke, we can hit a button, we can hit a key, and cause the smell of burning rubber to be pumped into the environment.
Mm.
We can hit another button and have the smell of gasoline or diesel fuel or gunpowder, cordite, fresh garbage, also body odor. We have a body odor scent. And so we work with a scent company that can produce some of these things. We also have Iraqi spices.
Wow. Now, on the face of it, it sounds re-traumatizing. I mean, here I am. I've been in battle. I've been exposed to all kinds of burning and killing and exploding, and I'm traumatized. And I come back, and you're going to plunge me back into this environment that has traumatized me?
Well, at first blush, it does seem, as you say, that it's sort of counterintuitive. But if you look at basic conditioning and learning theory over the last 100 years, you see that there are these principles related to habituation and extinction. And this is what is at the crux of these types of behavioral approaches towards treating anxiety disorders, whether they're simple phobias on one end, fear of heights or fear of flying, say, to the high end where you're dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a very difficult disorder to treat. And the idea here is that you're not going to put somebody in a virtual environment that is at the high end of the hierarchy, because that would be counterproductive. And there have been incidences where people have tried doing that as sort of a flooding approach, and
right, to
no real positive effect. With virtual reality, we're able to systematically manipulate the stimulus cues that are presented to the client in the environment, and to do that in the hands of a good clinician that understands exposure therapy, you can do it at a graduated progressive rate, so that, probably by example I can describe it better, you say somebody had a traumatizing event in Iraq where they're driving a Humvee and the vehicle in front of them blows up and so there's body parts in the road. Well, you wouldn't start the client off doing that. You would put them in a Humvee environment and have the surroundings maybe be desert-like, but something that would not be uncommon if you drove through any desert, say, in the United States, like go driving through Mojave or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that might be enough in the first session, that would raise anxiety at a level where it's manageable, but it still is a little bit uncomfortable for the client. But the key to this, and this comes from the work of Edna Foa and Barbara Rothbaum, you want to activate this fear structure and raise anxiety and keep the person at a certain low to moderate level of anxiety for a period of time. And eventually, by a sort of a counter-conditioning process, because nothing really bad happens to the person, eventually that anxiety dissipates in conjunction to the presentation of these stimulus cues.
Okay. So really it's kind of evolved out of, I guess, the older approach of systematic desensitization and then in vivo desensitization, where working with phobias, they take the person to the real environment that was scary. And now you're doing that with virtual reality.
Exactly. And, we all know that in vivo is probably the best thing that you can do. You know, if you do, say, fear of heights. Mm-hmm. Traditionally, exposure therapy has been done in imagination in the clinician's office.
Yes.
Pragmatically, that's, you know, you have to do it in the office. You have to protect the confidentiality of the client. But if you were to do graduated exposure, say, in a glass elevator at a hotel, and just getting the person in the first session to be in the glass elevator on the first floor might be challenging enough. But then the next session, they would go up to the second floor, and slowly but surely, eventually, the person habituates to the fear because they're getting some support from the therapist as well as exposure to the cues. Now, the thing that VR offers is that you can do the in vivo exposure, but in the clinician's office, so to speak. The data has demonstrated that when VR is matched head-to-head to imaginal exposure, it does a better job. It's clinically more effective.
Oh, there's actually been research on that.
Yeah, so over the last 10 years, there's a reasonable body. In fact, we just submitted a meta-analysis on this where we reviewed 55 studies, 19 of which actually met the criteria for the meta-analysis, and we saw pretty reasonable effect sizes. I did this with my colleague Tom Parsons. And so we know that it's better than imaginal exposure, and it's as good as in vivo exposure.
Okay.
Barbara Rothbaum has done some work with that with fear of flying. And so we're not aiming to beat in vivo, so to speak. We're just saying that this is pragmatically doable in a clinician's office. And
sure.
You can't do in vivo in a battlefield. So this is where the VR really makes a big difference. And particularly with PTSD, where one of the cardinal symptoms is avoidance of cues and reminders of the traumatic event. You're asking somebody to do imaginal exposure that has PTSD, and you never have any clear idea whether they're really imagining it at the emotional depth that's required for this therapeutic process of extinction and habituation to occur. So in VR, we know what the person is seeing, hearing, smelling, and feeling. We have a vibration platform as well that we use. It's pretty low cost. And we can systematically control the stimulus presentation. So you start off in a Humvee that's driving through an area that looks like Mojave, but by session 8 or 9, you've got Iraqi buildings in the desert. You've got insurgents popping up, helicopters flying over, the sound of weaponry going off in the distance or getting closer, vehicles exploding off in the distance, and so forth. So you have a range of control within this simulation. So probably the best metaphor is just as an aircraft simulator with test and train piloting ability, we can design virtual environments that test, train, treat, assess, rehabilitate folks in a similar manner.
Yeah, it's interesting that this device this could just as easily be used for training, it sounds like, as for healing.
Right. And this is where, a lot of the funding at the center that I work at USC comes from. We have a good bit of military money that comes in to do various types of training, not so much in the weapons operation area, but more in terms of decision-making and leadership. So you can put a person in a virtual environment and teach them cultural awareness by having them walk through an Iraqi village and practice some of their key language that they've learned some key phrases, practice how close they may stand to somebody, whether they put their hand out to shake, which might be a no-no in a certain culture, and so forth. And so the military has been on board with this for quite some time, not just for teaching people how to drive tanks or fly aircraft, but for how they interact and make command decisions under varying levels of stimulus, you know, complexity.
Yeah, let me just quickly run one thing by you here. It so happens that in the very last show that I did, I interviewed a psychologist in Israel who has a daily radio show there. And I was asking her about how people in Israel have learned to cope with the stress of terrorism and war, because they've been dealing with this stuff for so long. And one of the things she said that surprised me is that they don't try to get the PTSD victims to relive the experience because they find it tends to fix it in memory. Now, I can see from a learning theory point of view that rehearsal might not be a good thing. What's your reaction to that point of view?
Well, my first reaction as a good empirical clinician is, show me the data.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and I don't doubt that there probably is some data in some form from people doing research like this. I think that this person may be referring to some of the things that were done back about 10 years with the big movement towards debriefing, where there, after, say, a World Trade Center event, there was a big call for mandatory therapy or mandatory contact with people that had experienced this trauma, and it turned out to be at best not of much help, and at worst maybe counterproductive, because you did see people that may have adapted and adjusted over time on their own, but because of being forced to have to relive this and talk about it and so forth, it may have been counterproductive in some fashion. And so this is an important issue here, that the timing of therapy and the choice of therapy. But one other point is really important here, and that is that if you were to test people immediately after a traumatic event using the standard scales, like the gold standard or the clinician-administered PTSD scale, most people would score high enough to be diagnosed immediately after the trauma with PTSD. But, you know, we don't diagnose people immediately after trauma. We may call something like stress reaction or something. But PTSD is only diagnosed if after 30 days people are still experiencing these types of symptoms of re-experiencing, the hypervigilance and avoidance and so forth. Most folks, over time, through whatever adaptive mechanisms they have or whatever, gradually, if you administered the CAPS test 30 days out, you would see a substantial decrease in the self-report of symptomology. So people do naturally habituate and adapt, and it's a tribute to the resilience that many folks have to trauma. The population that we're interested in are not people that are naturally upset after a traumatic event occurs, but the people that are still upset a month later, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months later, all of a sudden they're having symptoms. Those are the folks, and that's when exposure therapy would be most called for or appropriate.
Is it still the case? I have the impression that early intervention is more effective than later intervention.
Yes. But by early intervention, we're defining a time period where you allow the natural habituation process to run its course. Mm-hmm. And if that doesn't happen, then early intervention would be 30, 60 days, somewhere in there.
Okay.
You know, we did see an application called Virtual Vietnam back in 1997 that was tested out with Vietnam vets. But this was 20 years after the fact, at least. And you know, the problem with PTSD is it starts off with that, but then, you know, you see all other correlated disorders emerge over time, particularly substance abuse. You know, if somebody is really traumatized by an event and having difficulty, a lot of times they self-medicate. And so you've got maybe 20 years of hard alcohol or other drug use that follows up. You see impairments in social relationships, intimacy problems. and those things snowball into a whole other set of problems. So it's best to catch it during this optimal time
right.
to be able to treat it at that point.
Yeah, I saw a lot of those kinds of guys when I was interning at the VA, and guys who were left over from World War II and Korea, and you know, it was really pretty much impossible to make much of a difference when so much time had gone by.
Right.
Now, has your system, Full Spectrum Warrior, has that actually been tested out on any GI suffering from PTSD yet?
Right now, we just started. We just sent our final, our current clinical version is now at the at Camp Pendleton and the San Diego Naval Medical Center, and the clinical trials for that are beginning. But what's happened over the last year and a half is that we've designed the application in cycles. So we would get a version of it and then get it in the hands of folks down at Pendleton and in San Diego, and also a version that was sent over to Iraq, and had people try it that were not defined patients, but rather just people that volunteered to experience it and then give us feedback. This is what we call user-centered design within virtual reality, where the targeted user or clinical group actually tries the scenario mm-hmm. and then gives us feedback to enhance the design. And so over the last year and a half, we've had literally hundreds of people try it, give us feedback, tell us what we got right and wrong, if we got the smells right and so forth. There's a graphic that just doesn't look like how it would look in the real world. And so we've evolved it over time so that now we have a very solid clinical application that's undergoing clinical trials. Now, with that said, we've had people that have volunteered for these user-centered trials to give us feedback that after the fact, you know, all of a sudden started saying, well, you know, I was in a convoy that was attacked, and the guy sitting next to me got his head blown off, and this and that. And one fella, in fact, he was featured on the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle last year, was in fact one of these fellas that volunteered, came in, and then came back a second time, said, I'd like to try that again, and went through it. And then it turned out that's when he revealed that he had had this pretty significant traumatic event, that he had a sleep disturbance and so forth, and that even with the early prototype, with a couple of trials, he came back a third time and actually really wanted to get into it, and had reported that he, you know, very anecdotal reporting,
right.
reported that he had felt he could cognitively reframe the experience a little better and understand what he had gone through, and that he was having a little bit better time sleeping at night. But, you know, I have to underscore, those are just very preliminary mm-hmm. anecdotal reports. And we've had a couple of following in the same vein as that. There's not anything you would hang your hat on as a proof of efficacy, but it was encouraging to hear that. Now the real test comes where, you know, we have a full clinical trial going down in San Diego, but we also have the application set up at Fort Lewis in Washington. We have a group headed up by Barbara Rothbaum down in Atlanta. Joanne DeFede in New York City at Cornell Weill Medical College has a version of the application. And Joanne is noteworthy in that she has done VR therapy with World Trade Center victims with a virtual World Trade Center attack. Mm. And has demonstrated in a waiting list controlled clinical trial improvements on the CAPS scale specifically, and that in the active treatment group, 6 of the 9 folks that were in that group were people that had tried imaginal exposure with no success, and then were admitted into the VR PTSD study and did demonstrate significant gains. So there's a lot of groups that are using our software now for different purposes to examine its efficacy and where and when it can be efficacious, and in cases, and as well to give us feedback, because we still have another year and a half of funding on our grant to continually evolve the application. So we're constantly getting emails and feedback reports from folks that are using it as to what we could do to make it a little bit better. So I'm optimistic that we might be onto a useful tool that will appeal to a generation of soldiers that grew up digital.
Yeah.
It may entice them into therapy more effectively. And the previous data with other applications for PTSD seem to support its efficacy. So I'm tentatively very optimistic.
Well, it's very exciting, almost science fiction sounding, and it will really be interesting to see the clinical data begin to roll in. I'm sure you're eager to see that happen.
Yeah,
and
it's
after
like waiting to open a Christmas
present. Right. And, you know, I was going through some of the materials you sent me, and at first I thought this interview was all about, you know, full spectrum warrior. But what I realized is that your work is really a lot broader than that, that you have a number of virtual reality projects relating to, I think, to other aspects of psychology. Is that true? And if so, yeah. Can you kind of give us a brief overview?
Sure. I think that probably I could characterize all the research that we're doing here now as looking for ways that we can apply the technology in a thoughtful manner with the goal of understanding how humans operate in simulated environments and how we can learn from that in order to help design better ways of measuring or assessing a person as well as treatment. So we've developed applications for assessing attention processes that we've tested with kids with ADHD. We built a virtual classroom where we can systematically deliver stimuli on the blackboard like a continuous performance task while systematically manipulating the distracting features of the classroom. So cars going by a window, a person walking into the classroom, a paper airplane flying around, so forth. And we've gotten some good results with that. And a number of groups are using that application now. We've also been doing quite a bit of work with motor rehabilitation, again, in more of a game-like format for people post-stroke. So our goal is to try to make the very boring and tedious motor rehabilitation fun and exciting and also meaningful for a client. So we've had, we just got really that project up and going over the last year. And we've run about six folks post-stroke through very intensive regimen, 2 hours a day, 5 days a week for a month, and seeing positive results with that, where they're wearing the headset and they're playing like a virtual handball game where the stimuli can be adjusted to be delivered within their range of motion. So if their range of motion is limited after a stroke with their upper extremity, with their arm, we can still deliver the stimuli in a way where they can play the game and then gradually over time move the stimuli, the targets out a little bit, and foster a sort of their inner competitiveness, give them a score, and so forth. And we've developed probably about 15 different motor rehab scenarios for that. Another area that we've worked in, we have a lab set up at Children's Hospital in Los Angeles with Jeffrey Gold to do pain distraction with virtual reality for common medical procedures. And our research in that area has been with common procedures like IV insertions and needle sticks, that there's an anxiety component as well as an actual pain component. And for children that are fearful, the data that we have show that when you put them in a head-mounted display, you're occluding them from the wound site or the site of insertion, so they're not watching the needle go in, but they're also engaged.
Clever.
In the game that they're playing. So those are areas that we're interested in. We just got a grant from the Alzheimer's Association to do a test with early Alzheimer's folks and healthy aged individuals in terms of measuring their ability to find their way around in a virtual environment. And how does that correlate with traditional tests that are used to help understand the early stages of dementia of the Alzheimer's type in order to be able to diagnose folks a little bit earlier on, so maybe we can do things to help slow the progression of the disorder. So we've got that. And, you know, a lot of times when I talk about this with sort of traditional academic folks, they, you know, they often say, geez, Skip, why don't you just do one thing? you know, that's what you're supposed to do in science. Yeah. Do one thing and study it intensively. And my answer to that is that I am doing one thing. I'm exploring how we can change the way we do psychology by using new technology and understanding how clients or patients with different types of disorders can operate within these virtual worlds so that we can know what the strengths and the limitations are. What are the limits and what are the things that we can do in a more effective way that would be beyond one therapist being able to manage all these variables in a clinical setting. Maybe we can give the clinician a tool that will be helpful. And it's not to replace a clinician, it's to extend the skills of the clinician. So it goes back to what we talked about in the very beginning, you know, where maybe psychologists have a sneaking subconscious desire to have tools to help them do their job better. And hopefully that is my research area to come up with those things. So,
well, that's great. You brought us full circle here. Really exciting work. If I were at the beginning of my career, if I were a student or a graduate student, I'd be trying to figure out how to come and work with you.
David, you're doing some great openings. It's never too late.
You got some great stuff going on there. Hey, thanks so much for being our guest here. This has really been a wonderful interview.
Okay, David, thank you for having me. I really appreciate that.
I hope you enjoyed this discussion of virtual reality with psychologist Skip Rizzo. The concept of using computers to generate a virtual reality environment goes back to the early 1980s and the pioneering work of an independent maverick inventor by the name of Jaron Lanier. In the early days of VR, there were very primitive goggles with small video screens in them, and there was a glove with sensors which would track your hand movements. And later, I seem to recall, there was a full bodysuit with sensors. Some years later, I recall encountering a very primitive VR setup in a video game arcade. As I recall, it was interesting, but not terribly compelling. The virtual reality concept is one that's been featured in sci-fi movies and novels. In fact, my favorite VR movie is Total Recall. I think that's my favorite Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, or should I say Governor of California movie. One of my favorite sci-fi novels is Snow Crash, in which the hero experiences a kind of second life in a virtual world that has all the dimensionality of this world. In fact, there's now an online game called Second Life, which I hear is extremely compelling, even though it doesn't use 3D surround technology. But it does incorporate the idea in Snow Crash of having a visual character that represents yourself, which is called an avatar. In Second Life, there's a booming economy. People pay other people to design their avatars or to invest their avatars with special powers, such as flight. They also pay for wardrobes for their avatars. They buy and sell property. And I hear even virtual sexual favors are bought and sold. Reportedly, at least one person has made a substantial amount of money buying and selling virtual property in Second Life. If you don't believe me, you can check all this out for yourself at http://secondlife.com. However you do so at your own risk, I hear it's quite addictive. One can only speculate how much more addictive it will be if the 3D surround sound total immersion capability arrives. Even without that, the power of imagination seems to make it quite immersive. The world of Second Life potentially opens up a whole new environment for psychological exploration. What sorts of human behavior arise in Second Life? Do people behave differently in their Second Life than in their First Life? Will it be possible to conduct psychological research in Second Life? Will it be possible to conduct psychological research in Second Life that would be ethically forbidden in First Life? If there were a perfect virtual reality machine like the one in Total Recall, and you had the choice of going into your ideal chosen fantasy environment, would you do it? Would you ever want to come out? That's a question I used to put to my students. What's your answer? Would you rather be plugged into a perfect artificial world or exist in this actual world? As a marketing research consultant, I was involved in testing many of the early video games for companies like Atari, Apple, and Electronic Arts. It's really been fascinating to me to see how rapidly video games have developed and the way in which they've become increasingly realistic. Of course, I'm concerned, as I'm sure many of you are, about the social dangers of hyper-violent and hyper-sexual games that are marketed to young people. It's nice to see, however, that there's another side of the coin in which people like Dr. Rizzo are working on socially beneficial applications of virtual reality technology to help people overcome a variety of psychological and physical disabilities.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
And speaking of Shrink Wrap Radio, this podcast marks our 1-year anniversary. Happy birthday, Shrink Wrap Radio. 48 episodes and 1 year. There certainly has been some evolution since this undertaking was only a gleam in my eye down to today. There was a lot of technology I had to master, and I'm still working on that. I've gone through 4 different microphones and 2 different preamps and 3 different portable digital recorders. When I undertook this, I never dreamed it would end up taking me about 10 hours to produce each episode. Also, the early interviews were with psychologist friends. I still haven't tapped out on those, but it's been fun to branch out to prominent psychological newsmakers whom I've never met, like today's guest. And then the format of the show has also evolved. Initially, I didn't close with PodSafe music, didn't have the Shrink Wrap Radio jingles. In recent shows, I took more risks in the direction of sharing personal stories. Where will it all go in the coming year? Well, I hope to keep growing the audience, and I still have lots of great guests in mind, even after a year. Plus, I'm getting great guest and topic suggestions from you, my audience. So once again, I say, happy birthday, Shrink Wrap Radio. If you use the discount code SHRINK3 at checkout on GoDaddy, you can buy the domain name FullSpectrumWimp.com for only $6.95 for a whole year. Just think how jealous your neighbors will be. We have just a few new additions to our Frapper map that shows where listeners are located. We have Jamie, who I just went to a didgeridoo festival with in California. And we have Sarah in Calgary, Canada. We have Jim in Nazareth, Pennsylvania. Joel in Portland, Maine. Philip in Brisbane, Australia, Carolyn in Rome, Moshe in Israel, and Marianne in Charleston, South Carolina, and finally Lloyd in Perth, Western Australia. Thanks so much for signing up on the map, folks. Now, don't forget, you can win a free autographed copy of the book I co-authored, in which I profile the infamous Zodiac serial killer. All you have to do is put yourself on our Frapper map by going to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio, or you'll find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. And also drop me an email if you're at all interested in attending the workshop I'll be co-leading in Tuscany, Italy, from September 18th to the 24th. Hurry, as you can see, time's running out.
Hi, this is Lloyd from Australia. And you are on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Lloyd, thanks so much for that transition. Please feel free to follow Lloyd's example by clicking on the My Chingo logo on the shrinkwrapradio.com webpage and recording a nice transition or leaving other feedback. Or you can leave voicemail on Skype, where our name there is ShrinkPod. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. And we also have an evolving MySpace page thanks to the help of April Fresh Goddess at myspace.com/shrinkpod. Now on to some of the recent emails from listeners. And in fact, our first email is from Lloyd, who among other things says, on another note, I had a dream last night of two happy, bubbling babies sitting in an oven. At first I was worried it might be too hot for them, but then I saw the dial was set to a low temperature and I knew they would be all right. It was a significant dream because my wife is now pregnant with my first child. I'm slightly worried. This means we might be having twins. In any case, I'm glad they were healthy and happy. Well, I've certainly heard the expression, Lloyd, of having a bun in the oven. Hey, if you do have two buns in the oven, I can tell you I am the father of twins, and it's been one of the most joyful things in my entire life. Twins are wonderful, and I wish them upon you. Next, we hear from Judy, who writes, Dear Dr. Dave, I enjoy listening to your show. I'm a relatively new listener and have not heard all of your previous shows, so I hope this email is not something you've already discussed on your show. However, I feel that the topic is so important that I will risk looking foolish and send this email anyway. I thought of you when I watched a BBC series by Adam Curtis called Century of Self. It's about Edward Bernays, a nephew of Freud. He applied Freud's theories of the unconscious and human behavior to marketing and public relations, apparently with great success, if this documentary is accurate. Episode 1 of the series describes how Bernays changed public opinion, increasing social acceptability of such things as women smoking, going to war, and certain political candidates. I hope you will watch at least the first episode, and if you agree that this is an important and worthwhile topic to explore, consider covering it on your show. It's unavailable in the U.S. at this time, but it is available for download on the internet at, and then she gives the link, which I'll give you the short part, and then you can hunt for the exact episode, but it's at www.archive.org, and then you would search for search on the name Curtis, and I think you'll find the show that she's talking about. I really appreciate that recommendation, Judy. I also see that you're a school psychologist, and I always feel good when other professionals find value in the show here. I have done some previous episodes about the relationship between psychology and market research, since I'm involved in market research myself. I'm not sure that I knew that the nephew of Sigmund Freud had had such an impact in the world of advertising and marketing. And I have downloaded that episode, but I haven't found time to watch it yet, but I do hope to get to it before too much longer. Listener James writes, Dr. Dave, great show, but please increase the sound levels, as often during interviews, the sound levels and quality are poor. It just seems to be the interviewee sound levels that are affected. Keep up the good work, as the shows are very informative. Well, thanks for that feedback, James, and I have been wrestling with the sound issues, continue to do so. I'm hoping you had not heard the most recent show, because I think I've been getting on top of that issue recently. I hope I'm getting on top of it, but there's always room for improvement. And finally, we hear from another professional psychologist, a PhD licensed psychologist, listener Joel, who writes, Dr. Dave, I have enjoyed your podcast recently. It makes my hour-long train commute from Portland, Maine to Dover, New Hampshire much more enjoyable, though it's very nice on its own. I was really tickled to get this because I lived right near Dover, New Hampshire for 2 years while I was on exchange teaching at the University of New Hampshire. I traded jobs and houses with a professor at the University of New Hampshire, and it was a wonderful 2-year period in my life. I have great affection for that region. Listener Joel goes on to say, I thought I would suggest a topic, acceptance and commitment therapy, known as ACT. said as the word, not as the letters ACT, ACT is a rapidly growing form of psychotherapy with much promise to help alleviate our clients' suffering. It is deeply humanizing, grounded in a coherent model and philosophy, and has a strong connection to basic science. It's often considered a form of cognitive behavioral therapy, though some would disagree, and will certainly challenge anyone who thinks cognitive behavioral therapies are superficial and neglect the significance and power of the therapeutic relationship. Well said. There are many folks on the West Coast getting involved in ACT, so I'm sure you could find someone to interview out there. And he mentions the University of Nevada at Reno as a focal point of ACT. Try there. You can find much more info at www.contextualpsychology.org. I hope to see it in your lineup soon. In the meantime, keep up the great work. Sincerely, Joel. Joel, thanks so much for that recommendation, and I will plan to follow up on it. I already have a kind of a roster of upcoming shows, so it may not appear in the immediate future, but it will definitely find a place on my list. I'm not aware of ACT therapy before you're writing this, and I'm surprised that I haven't heard about it. So I'm looking forward to discovering what I can and sharing it with the audience. If you're not subscribed to Shrink Wrap Radio, I would encourage you to do so. You can subscribe right on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. You'll find an iTunes link there that will allow you to subscribe. Or you can do a search for Shrink Wrap Radio as three separate words in iTunes and subscribe there. Or you can do so by going to shrinkwrapradio.podshow.com. And they have a player right there where you can listen to your favorite shows, including Shrink Wrap Radio, I hope. And I believe you can also download it to your MP3 player from there. And there's also a place on the podshow.com site where you can leave your comments and reviews, and I would sure love to see those. So please help us to grow our audience by spreading the word about Shrink Wrap Radio to your friends and colleagues. I want to thank Jason Mannheim, who mentioned us favorably on his blog, Making the Best of a Job. We always appreciate those blog mentions. Those of you on MySpace, I just learned that you can post bulletins to MySpace groups, some of which are very large. If you're in a group, how about posting a bulletin recommending Shrink Wrap Radio to the members of that group? Now to wrap things up, thanks again to Dr. Skip Rizzo for sharing his exciting work on the frontiers of virtual reality and psychology. And we close today's show with a PodSafe tune by famed Central Park musician David Ippolito called Crazy on the Same Day, which appropriately expresses the sentiment, thank heaven we're not all crazy on the same day. You'll find a link to this tune in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Said you woke up feeling frightened, senses heightened, overwhelmed, lost and alone, a little overwrought until you finally thought that you'd drop it all and pick up the phone, and it didn't do nothing but really listen to everything you had to say, until I knew that you'd be okay. The next week it was my turn, I was in a slow burn, about something or nothing at all. I don't even remember, but I remember, I was hurting so I gave you a call, and you didn't do nothing but really listen to everything I had to say, until you knew that I'd be okay. Never been a day. got your call to tell them all about your life. There was a DJ, doctor, and a man who was going on and on about some trouble with his father and his wife. It's funny, but the doctor probably makes a lot of money just to listen to what he has to say. And then she tells him he's okay. They take turns being angels for one another, cause there's never been a day when we all wanna stay under the covers. I guess we're just all lucky that it works that way. Thank heaven we're not all crazy on the same day. We're not crazy. Oh.